Cory Doctorow. Read by Will Wheaton.
Hi, this is Cory Doctorow with a brief word about the history of this audiobook. When Homeland came out a year ago, many fans wrote to ask where they could buy the audio edition. I had to tell them that there wasn't one in the works. Random House Audio, who published the audiobooks for my previous novels, wasn't going to take on the expense of doing Homeland, even though it was the sequel to Little Brother, easily my best-selling novel to date. I couldn't blame them. The problem was that Audible, the largest audiobook distributor in the world, refused to carry my books, and without their support, 90% of the market was cut off for me. Oh, my audiobooks did incredibly well outside of Audible. I probably sell more audiobooks direct from my site than any other author in the world, but it's all small potatoes compared to Audible's market. Why wouldn't Audible carry my books? Well, technically they would, but only if I'd allow them to put the books in a special cryptographically locked wrapper called Digital Rights Management, or DRM. Instead of selling you an MP3 of my book, which you can play on any device, Audible insists on selling you a .aa file that can only be played on Audible-approved hardware and software. Under a 1998 U.S. law called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, or DMCA, it's illegal to make a player for an AA file without Audible's permission. It's even illegal to describe how the AA player and format work. Audible says that this is all to prevent piracy, even though the AA file format has been broken for years. Pretty much any audiobook on Audible can be downloaded for free from popular torrent sites like the Pirate Bay. I think it's fair to say that locking customers, authors, and publishers to Audible's platform has more to do with their DRM policy than piracy. But here's the thing. Even if this is about piracy, it's piracy of my book. Audible, the mere distributor of my work, has no business insisting that obnoxious anti-copying technology be applied to my copyrighted work if I object. When Random House and I asked Audible to sell my books without DRM, they turned us down. Audible is the supplier of downloadable audiobooks for Amazon and iTunes. If you love audiobooks like me, chances are you spent a lot of money with them. When I finally broke away from Audible, I'd already spent thousands of dollars with them, and it took me a whole month of running three old laptops 24/7 to get my books in a format that I could take out of Audible jail and use with my unapproved devices. Audible are the giant in the field, and everyone in the industry is really afraid of them. Three different audio publishers told me that they wouldn't carry my audiobooks if they included an introduction like this one, even if the book was never offered for sale through Audible. No one wants to offend the company that controls 90% of the market. I listen to a ton of spoken word audio, podcasts, audiobooks, radio. Audible's all over it, advertising its really excellent catalog, but I haven't given Audible a dime in 10 years. Don't worry, I'm not going to ask you to do the same. All I ask is, if you like this audiobook, please drop Audible customer service a line and ask them to allow authors to choose whether or not DRM is applied to their works. There's no possible piracy-related justification for imposing DRM against the wishes of creators. And until Audible changes its policy and decides to let the copyright holders choose whether or not to use DRM, you'll always be able to buy my audiobooks, this one and many others, from my website at craphound.com. They come as MP3s without any DRM, and when you buy them, the money goes directly to the creator, that's me, and to publishers that had the integrity to let me refuse to sell on Audible unless I get the final say on DRM. Thank you. I hope you love Will's reading of Homeland as much as I do. Cory Doctorow, March the 6th, 2014, London, England.
Chapter 1. Attending Burning Man made me simultaneously one of the most photographed people on the planet and one of the least surveilled humans in the modern world. I adjusted my burnous, covering up my nose and mouth and tucking its edge into place under the lower rim of my big, scratched goggles. The sun was high, the temperature well over 100 degrees, and breathing through the embroidered cotton scarf made it even more stifling. But the wind had just kicked up, and there was a lot of playa dust, fine gypsum sand, deceptively soft and powdery, but alkali enough to make your eyes burn and your skin crack. And after 2 days in the desert, I had learned that it was better to be hot than to choke. Pretty much everyone was holding a camera of some kind. Mostly phones, of course, but also big SLRs and even old-fashioned film cameras, including a genuine antique plate camera whose operator hid out from the dust under a huge black cloth that made me hot just to look at it. Everything was ruggedized for the fine, blowing dust, mostly through the simple expedient of sticking it in a Ziploc bag, which is what I'd done with my phone. I turned around slowly to get a panorama and saw that the man walking past me was holding the string for a gigantic helium balloon 100 yards overhead, from which dangled a digital video camera. Also, the man holding the balloon was naked. Well, not entirely. He was wearing shoes. I understood that. Playa dust is hard on your feet. They call it playa foot when the alkali dust dries out your skin so much that it starts to crack and peel. Everyone agrees that playa foot sucks. Burning Man is a festival held every Labor Day weekend in the middle of Nevada's Black Rock Desert. 50,000 people show up in this incredibly harsh, hot, dusty environment and build a huge city, Black Rock City, and participate. Spectator is a vicious insult in Black Rock City. Everyone's supposed to be doing stuff, and yeah, also admiring everyone else's stuff, hence all the cameras. At Burning Man, everyone is the show. I wasn't naked, but the parts of me that were showing were decorated with elaborate mandalas laid on with colored zinc. A lady as old as my mother, wearing a tie-dyed wedding dress, had offered to paint me that morning, and she'd done a great job. That's another thing about Burning Man. It runs on a gift economy, which means that you generally go around offering nice things to strangers a lot, which makes for a surprisingly pleasant environment. The designs the painter had laid down made me look amazing, and there were plenty of cameras aiming my way as I ambled across the open desert toward 9 o'clock. Black Rock City is a pretty modern city. It has public sanitation, portable chem toilets decorated with raunchy poems reminding you not to put anything but toilet paper in them, electricity and internet service. At 6 o'clock, the main plaza in the middle of the ring-shaped city, something like a government, the nonprofit that runs Burning Man, several local newspapers, all of them doing better than the newspapers in the real world, a dozen radio stations, an all-volunteer police force, the Black Rock Rangers, who patrolled wearing tutus or parts of chicken suits or glitter paint, and many other amenities associated with the modern world. But BRC has no official surveillance. There are no CCTVs, no checkpoints, at least not after the main gate where tickets are collected, no ID checks at all, no bag searches, no ARFID sniffers, no mobile phone companies logging your movements. There was also no mobile phone service. No one drives, except for the weird art cars registered with the Department of Mutant Vehicles, so there were no license plate cameras and no sniffers for your easy passes. The Wi-Fi was open and unlogged. Attendees at Burning Man agreed not to use their photos commercially without permission, and it was generally considered polite to ask people before taking their portraits. So, there I was, having my picture taken through the blowing dust as I gulped down water from the water jug I kept clipped to my belt at all times, sucking at the stubby built-in straw under cover of the blue and silver burnoose, simultaneously observed and observer, simultaneously observed and unsurveilled, and it was glorious. Woohoo! I shouted to the dust and the art cars and the naked people and the enormous wooden splay-armed effigy perched atop a pyramid straight ahead of me in the middle of the desert. This was the man, and we'd burn him in 3 nights, and that's why it was called Burning Man. I couldn't wait. "You're in a good mood," a Jawa said from behind me. Even with the tone shifter built into its dust mask, the cloaked sand person had an awfully familiar voice. "Ange?" I said. We'd been missing each other all that day, ever since I'd woken up an hour before her and snuck out of the tent to catch the sunrise, which was awesome. And we'd been leaving each other notes back at camp all day about where we were heading next. Ange had spent the summer spinning up the Jawa robes, working with cooling towels that trapped sweat as it evaporated, channeling it back over her skin for extra evaporative cooling. She'd hand-dyed it a mottled brown, tailored it into the characteristic monkish robe shape, and added crossed bandoliers. These exaggerated her breasts, which made the whole thing entirely and totally warsome. She hadn't worn it out in public yet, and now, in the dust and the glare, she was undoubtedly the greatest sand person I'd ever met. I hugged her, and she hugged me back so hard it knocked the wind out of me, one of her trademarked wrestling hold cuddles. I smudged your paint, she said through the voice shifter after we unclinched. I got zinc on your robes, I said. She shrugged. Like it matters. We both look fabulous. Now, what have you seen, and what have you done, and where have you been, young man? Where to start? I said. I'd been wandering up and down the radial avenues that cut through the city, lined with big camps sporting odd exhibits. One camp where a line of people were efficiently making snow cones for anyone who wanted them, working with huge blocks of ice and a vicious ice shaver. Then a camp where someone had set up a tall, linoleum-covered slide that you could toboggan down on a plastic magic carpet after first dumping a gallon of wastewater over the lino to make it plenty slippery. It was a very clever way to get rid of gray water. That's water that you've showered in or used to wash your dishes or hands, black water being water that's got poo or pee in it. One of the other Burning Man rules was leave no trace. When we left, we'd take every scrap of Black Rock City with us, and that included all the gray water. But the slide made for a great gray water evaporator, and every drop of liquid that the sliders helped turn into vapor was a drop of liquid the camp wouldn't have to pack all the way back to Reno. There'd been pervy camps, where they were teaching couples to tie each other up. A junk food glory hole that you put your mouth over in order to receive a mysterious and unhealthy treat. I'd gotten a mouthful of some kind of super sugary breakfast cereal studded with coconut marshmallows shaped like astrological symbols. A camp where they were offering free service for playa bikes, beater bikes caked with playa dust and decorated with glitter and fun fur and weird fetishes and bells. A tea house camp where I'd been given a very precisely made cup of some kind of Japanese tea I'd never heard of that was delicious and sharp. Camps full of whimsy, camps full of physics, camps full of optical illusions, camps full of men and women, a kids' camp full of screaming kids running around playing some kind of semi-supervised outdoor game. Things I'd never suspected existed, and I'd only seen a tiny slice of Black Rock City. I told Ange about as much as I could remember, and she nodded or said ooh or ah or demanded to know where I'd seen things. Then she told me about the stuff she'd seen. A camp where topless women were painting one another's breasts. A camp where an entire brass band was performing. A camp where they'd built a medieval trebuchet that fired ancient broken-down pianos down a firing range, the audience holding its breath in total silence while they waited for the glorious crash each piano made when it exploded into flinders on the hard-packed desert. "Can you believe this place?" Ange said, jumping up and down on the spot in excitement, making her bandoliers jingle. "I know. Can you believe we almost didn't make it?" I'd always sort of planned on going out to see the man burn. After all, I grew up in San Francisco, the place with the largest concentration of burners in the world. But it took a lot of work to participate in Burning Man. First, there was the matter of packing for a camping trip in the middle of the desert, where you had to pack in everything, including water, and then pack it all out again, everything you didn't leave behind in the porta-potties. And there were very strict rules about what could go in those. Then there was the gift economy, figuring out what I could bring to the desert that someone else might want, plus the matter of costumes, cool art and inventions to show off. Every time I started to think about it, I just about had a nervous breakdown. But this year, of all years, I'd made it. This was the year both my parents lost their jobs. This year I dropped out of college rather than take on any more student debt. The year I'd spent knocking on every door I could find, looking for paid work, anything, without getting even a nibble. Never underestimate the determination of a kid who is cash poor and time rich, Ange said solemnly, pulling down her face mask with one hand and yanking me down to kiss me with the other. That's catchy, I said. You should print t-shirts. Oh, she said, that reminds me. I got a t-shirt. She threw open her robe to reveal a proud red tee that read, Make beautiful art and set it on fire. Laid out like those British Keep Calm and Carry On posters, with the Burning Man logo where the crown should be. Just in time, too, I said, holding my nose. I was only partly kidding. At the last minute, we'd both decided to ditch half the clothes we'd planned on bringing so that we could fit more parts for Secret Project X1 into our backpacks. Between that and taking bits and pits baths by rubbing the worst of the dried sweat, body paint, sunscreen, and miscellaneous fluids off with baby wipes once a day, neither of us smelled very nice. She shrugged. The playa provides. It was one of the Burning Man mottos we picked up on the first day, when we both realized that we thought the other one had brought the sunscreen. And just as we were about to get into an argument about it, we stumbled on sunscreen camp, where some nice people had slathered us all over with SPF 50 and given us some baggies to take with. The playa provides, they'd said, and wished us well. I put my arm around her shoulders. She dramatically turned her nose up at my armpit, then made a big show of putting on her face mask. Come on, she said. Let's go out to the temple. The temple was a huge two-story sprawling structure, dotted with high towers and flying buttresses. It was filled with robotic Tibetan gongs that played strange clanging tunes throughout the day. I'd seen it from a distance that morning while walking around the playa, watching the sun turn the dust rusty orange, but I hadn't been up close. The outer wings of the temple were open to the sky, made of the same lumber as the rest of the whole elaborate curlicue structure. The walls were lined with benches and were inset with niches and nooks. And everywhere, every surface, was covered in writing and signs and posters and pictures. And almost all of it was about dead people. Oh, Ange said to me as we trailed along the walls, reading the memorials that had been inked or painted or stapled there. I was reading a handwritten, 30-page long letter from an adult woman to her parents about all the ways they'd hurt her and made her miserable and destroyed her life, about how she'd felt when they'd died, about how her marriages had been destroyed by the craziness she'd had instilled in her. It veered from wild accusation to tender exasperation to anger to sorrow, like some kind of emotional roller coaster. I felt like I was spying on something I wasn't supposed to see, except that everything in the temple was there to be seen. Every surface in the temple was a memorial to something or someone. There were baby shoes and pictures of grannies, a pair of crutches, and a beat-up cowboy hat with a hatband woven from dead dried flowers. Burners, dressed and undressed like a circus from the end of the world, walked solemnly around these, reading them, more often than not with tears running down their faces. Pretty soon, I had tears running down my face. It moved me in a way that nothing had ever moved me before, especially since it was all going to burn on Sunday night before we tore down Black Rock City and went home. Ange sat in the dust and began looking through a sketchbook whose pages were filled with dense, dark illustrations. I wandered into the main atrium of the temple, a tall, airy space whose walls were lined with gongs. Here, the floor was carpeted with people, sitting and lying down, eyes closed, soaking in the solemnity of the moment, some with small smiles, some weeping, some with expressions of utmost serenity. I'd tried meditating once during a drama class at high school. It hadn't worked very well. Some of the kids kept on giggling. There was some kind of shouting going on in the hallway outside the door, The clock on the wall ticked loudly, reminding me that at any moment there'd be a loud buzzer and the roar and stamp of thousands of kids all trying to force their way through a throng to their next class. But I'd read a lot about meditation and how good it was supposed to be for you. In theory, it was easy, too. Just sit down and think of nothing. So I did. I shifted my utility belt around so that I could sit down without it digging into my ass, and waited until a patch of floor was vacated, then sat. There were streamers of sunlight piercing the high windows above, lancing down in gray-gold spikes that glittered with dancing dust. I looked into one of these, at the dancing motes, and then closed my eyes. I pictured a grid of four squares, featureless and white, with thick black rims and sharp corners. In my mind's eye, I erased one square, then another, then another. Now there was just one square. I erased it. There was nothing now. I was thinking of nothing, literally. Then I was thinking about the fact that I was thinking about nothing, mentally congratulating myself, and I realized that I was thinking of something again. I pictured my four squares and started over. I don't know how long I sat there, but there were moments when the world seemed to both go away and be more present than it ever had been. I was living in that exact and very moment, not anticipating anything that might happen later, not thinking of anything that had just happened, just being right there. It only lasted for a fraction of a second each time, but each of those fragmentary moments were, well, they were something. I opened my eyes. I was breathing in time with the gongs around me, a slow, steady cadence. There was something digging into my butt, a bit of my utility belt strap or something. The girl in front of me had a complex equation branded into the skin of her shoulder blades. The burned skin curdled into deep, sharp relief mathematical symbols and numbers. Someone smelled like weed. Someone was sobbing softly. Someone outside the temple called out to someone else. Someone laughed. Time was like molasses, flowing slowly and stickily around me. Nothing seemed important, and everything seemed wonderful. That was what I'd been looking for all my life, without ever knowing it. I smiled. "Hello, Mikey," a voice hissed in my ear, very soft and very close, lips brushing my lobe, breath tickling me. The voice tickled me too, tickled my memory. I knew that voice, though I hadn't heard it in a very long time. Slowly, as though I were a giraffe with a neck as tall as a tree, I turned my head to look around. "Hello, Masha," I said softly. "Fancy meeting you here." Her hand was on my hand, and I remembered the way she'd twisted my wrist around in some kind of martial arts hold the last time I'd seen her. I didn't think she'd be able to get away with bending my arm up behind my back and walking me out of the temple on my tiptoes. If I shouted for help, thousands of burners would... well, they wouldn't tear her limb from limb, but they'd do something. Kidnapping people on the playa was definitely against the rules. It was in the 10 principles. I was nearly certain of it. She tugged at my wrist. "Let's go," she said. "Come on." I got to my feet and followed her, freely and of my own will, and even though I trembled with fear as I got up, there was a nugget of excitement in there, too. Of course this was happening now, at Burning Man. A couple years ago, I'd been in the midst of more excitement than anyone would or could want. I'd led a techno-guerrilla army against the Department of Homeland Security, met a girl and fallen in love with her, been arrested and tortured, found celebrity and sued the government. Since then, it had all gone downhill in a weird way. Being waterboarded was terrible, awful, unimaginable. I still had nightmares. But it happened, and then it ended. My parents' slow slide into bankruptcy, The hard, grinding reality of a city with no jobs for anyone, let alone a semi-qualified college dropout like me, and the student debt that I had to pay every month. It was a pile of misery that I lived under every day, and it showed no sign of going away. It wasn't dramatic, dynamic trouble, the kind of thing you got war stories out of years after the fact. It was just, you know, reality. And reality sucked. So I went with Masha, because Masha had been living underground with Zeb for the better part of 2 years, and whatever else she was someone whose life was generating a lot of exciting stories. Her reality might suck too, but it sucked in huge, showy, neon letters, not in the quiet, crabbed handwriting of a desperate and broke teenager scribbling in his diary. I went with Masha, and she led me out of the temple. The wind was blowing worse than it had been before, real whiteout conditions, and I pulled down my goggles and pulled up my scarf again. Even with them on, I could barely see, and each breath of air filled my mouth with the taste of dried saliva and powdery gypsum from my burnous. Masha's hair wasn't bright pink anymore. It was a mousy blonde brown, turned gray with dust, cut into duckling fuzz all over. The kind of haircut you could maintain yourself with a clipper. I'd had that haircut, off and on, through much of my adolescence. Her skull bones were fine and fragile. Her skin stretched like paper over her cheekbones. Her neck muscles corded, and her jaw muscles jumped. She'd lost weight since I'd seen her last, and her skin had gone leathery brown, a color that was deeper than a mere summer tan. We went all of 10 steps out from the temple. But we might have been a mile from it. It was lost in the dust. There were people around, but I couldn't make out their words over the spooky moan of the wind blowing through the temple's windows. Bits of grit crept between my goggles and my sweaty cheeks and made my eyes and nose run. "Far enough," she said, and let go of my wrist, holding her hands before her. I saw that the fingertips on her left hand were weirdly deformed and squashed and bent. And I had a vivid recollection of slamming the rolling door of a moving van down on her hand as she chased me. She'd been planning to semi-kidnap me at the time, and I was trying to get away with evidence that my best friend Daryl had been kidnapped by Homeland Security, but I still heard the surprised and pained shout she'd let out when the door crunched on her hand. She saw where I was looking and took her hand away, tucking it into the sleeve of the loose cotton shirt she wore. "How's tricks, Mikey?" she said. "It's Marcus these days," I said. "Tricks have been better. How about you? Can't say I expected to see you again. Ever. Especially not at Burning Man." Her eyes crinkled behind her goggles, and her veil shifted, and I knew she was smiling. "Why Mikey? Marcus. It was the easiest way for me to get to see you." It wasn't exactly a secret that I was planning to come to Burning Man that year. I'd been posting desperate, "We'll trade work for a ride to the playa," and "Want to borrow your old camping gear" messages to Craigslist and the Hackerspace mailing lists for months, trying to prove that the proverbial time-rich kid could out-determination cash pornus. Anyone who was trying to figure out where I was going to be over Labor Day weekend could have Googled my semi-precise location in about 3 seconds. I said, "Look, Masha, you know, you're kind of freaking me out. Are you here to kill me or something? Where's Zeb?" She closed her eyes, and the pale dust sifted down between us. "Zeb's off enjoying the playa. Last time I saw him, he was volunteering in the cafe and waiting to go to a yoga class. He's actually a pretty good barista, better than he is at being a yogi anyway. And no, I'm not going to kill you. I'm going to give you something and leave it up to you to decide what to do with it."
"You're going to give me something?"
"Yeah, it's a gift economy around here, haven't you heard?"
"What exactly are you going to give me, Masha?"
She shook her head. "Better you don't know until we make the handoff. Technically, it would be better, for you, at least, if you never knew. But that's how it goes." She seemed to be talking to herself now.
Being underground had changed her. She was, I don't know, hinky. Like something was wrong with her. Like she was up to something. Or like she could run at any second. She'd been so self-confident and decisive and unreadable. Now she seemed half crazy. Or maybe one quarter crazy and one quarter terrified. "Tonight," she said, "they're going to burn the Library of Alexandria at 8 p.m. After that burn, walk out to the trash fence directly opposite 6 o'clock. Wait for me if I'm not there when you show up. I've got stuff to do first." "Okay," I said. "I suppose I can do that. Will Zeb be there? I'd love to say hello to him again." She rolled her eyes. "Zeb will probably be there, but you might not see him. You come alone, and come out dark. No lights, got it?" "No," I said. "Actually, no. I'm with Ange, as you must know, and I'm not going out there without her, assuming she wants to come." "And no lights? You've got to be kidding me." For a city of 50,000 people involved with recreational substances, flaming art, and enormous mutant machines, Black Rock has a remarkably low mortality rate. But in a city where they laughed at danger, walking after dark without lights, lots of lights, preferably, was considered borderline insane. One of the most dangerous things you could do at Burning Man was walk the playa at night without illumination. That made you a darktard, and darktards were at risk of being run into by art bikes screaming over the dust in the inky night. They risked getting crushed by mammoth art cars, and they were certain to be tripped over and kicked and generally squashed. Burning Man's unofficial motto might have been "safety third," but no one liked a darktard. She closed her eyes and stood statue still. The wind was dying down a little, but I still felt like I'd just eaten a pound of talcum powder, and my eyes were stinging like I'd been pepper sprayed. "Bring your girlie if you must, but no lights, not after you get out past the last car. And if both of you end up in trouble because you wouldn't come out alone, you'll know whose fault it was." She turned on her heel and walked off into the dust, and she was out of my sight in a minute. I hurried back to the temple to find Ange.
Chapter 2.
They burn a lot of stuff at Burning Man. Of course, there's the burning of the man himself on Saturday night. I'd seen that on video 100 times from 100 angles with many different men. He's different every year. It's raucous and primal, and the explosives hidden in his base made huge mushroom clouds when they went off. The temple burn on Sunday night was as quiet and solemn as the man's burn was insane and frenetic. But before either of them get burned, there are lots of little burns. The night before, there'd been the burning of the regional art. Burner affinity groups from across America, Canada, and the rest of the world had designed and built beautiful wooden structures, ranging from something the size of a park bench up to three-story tall fanciful towers. These ringed the circle of open playa in the middle of Black Rock City, and we'd gone and seen all of them the day we arrived, because we'd been told that they'd burn first. And they did. All at once, more than any one person could see, each one burning in its own way as burners crowded around them, held at a safe distance by Black Rock Rangers, until the fires collapsed into stable configurations, masses of burning lumber on burn platforms over the playa. Anything that burned got burned on a platform, because leave no trace meant that you couldn't even leave behind scorch marks. That had been pretty spectacular. But tonight, they were going to burn the Library of Alexandria. Not the original, of course. Julius Caesar, or someone, burned that one in 48 BC, taking with it the largest collection of scrolls that had ever been assembled at that time. It wasn't the first library anyone had burned, and it wasn't the last, but it was the library that symbolized the wanton destruction of knowledge. The Burning Man Library of Alexandria was set on 24 great wheels, on 12 great axles, and it could be hauled across the playa by gangs of hundreds of volunteers who tugged at the ropes affixed to its front. Inside, the columned building was lined with nooks that were in turn stuffed with scrolls, each one handwritten, each a copy of some public domain book downloaded from Project Gutenberg and hand-transcribed onto long rolls of paper by volunteers who'd worked at the project all year. 50,000 books had been converted to scrolls in this fashion, and they would all burn. Libraries burn. It was the message stenciled at irregular intervals all over the Library of Alexandria and sported by the librarians who volunteered there, fetching you scrolls and helping you find the passages you were looking for. I'd gone in and read some Mark Twain, a funny story I remembered reading in school about when Twain had edited an agricultural newspaper. I'd been delighted to discover that someone had gone to the trouble of writing that one out, using rolled-up lined school notepaper and taping it together in a continuous scroll that went on for hundreds of yards. As I helped the librarian roll up the scroll, she agreed that the Twain piece was really funny, and put it away. I'd said, unthinkingly, "It's such a shame that they're going to burn all these." She'd smiled sadly and said, "Well, sure, but that's the point, isn't it? 90% of the works in copyright are orphan works. No one knows who owns the rights to them, and no one can figure out how to put them back into print. Meanwhile, the copies of them that we do know about are disintegrating or getting lost. So, there's a library out there, the biggest library ever, 90% of the stuff anyone's ever created, and it's burning in slow motion." "Libraries burn," she shrugged. "That's what they do. But maybe someday we'll figure out how to make so many copies of humanity's creative works that we'll save most of them from the fire." And I read my Mark Twain and felt the library rock gently under me, as the hundreds of rope pullers out front dragged the Library of Alexandria from one side of the open playa to the other, inviting more patrons to get on board and have a ride and read a book before it all burned down. On the way out, the librarian gave me a thumb drive. "It's a compressed copy of the Gutenberg Archive. 50,000 books and counting. There's also a list of public domain books that we don't have, and a list of known libraries by city where they can be found. Feel free to get a copy and scan or retype it." The little thumb drive only weighed an ounce or two, but it felt as heavy as a mountain of books as I slipped it gravely into my pocket. And now it was time to burn the Library of Alexandria again. The library had been hauled onto a burn platform, and the hauling ropes were coiled neatly on its porch. Black Rock Rangers, in their ranger hats and weird clothes, surrounded it in a wide circle, sternly warning anyone who wandered too close to stay back. Ange and I stood on the front line, watching as a small swarm of Bureau of Land Management feds finished their inspection of the structure. I could see inside, see the incendiary charges that had been placed at careful intervals along the library's length, see the rolled scrolls in their nooks. I felt weird tears in my eyes as I contemplated what was about to happen, tears of awe and sorrow and joy. Ange noticed and wiped the tears away, kissed my ear and whispered, "It's okay. Libraries burn." Now three men stepped out of the crowd. One was dressed as Caesar, in white Roman robes and crown, sneering magnificently. The next wore monkish robes and a pointed mitre with a large cross on it. He was meant to be Theophilus, Patriarch of Alexandria, another suspect in the burning of the library. He looked beatifically on the crowd, then turned to Caesar. Finally, there was a man in a turban with a pointed beard. Caliph Omar, the final person usually accused of history's most notorious arson. The three shook hands, then each drew a torch out of his waistband and lit it from a fire pot burning in the center of the library's porch. They paced off from one another and stationed themselves in the middle of the back and side walls, and, as the audience shouted and roared, thrust their torches lovingly in little holes set at the bottom of the walls. There must have been some kind of flash powder or something in those nooks, because as each man scurried away, great arcs of flame shot out of them, up and out, scorching the library walls. The walls burned merrily, and there was wood smoke and gunpowder in the air now, the wind whipping it toward and past us, fanning the flames. The crowd noise increased, and I realized I was part of the chorus, making a kind of drawn-out, happy yelp. Now the incendiary charges went. In near-perfect sync, a blossom of fire that forced its way out between the library's columns, the fire's tongues lashing its sizzling embers, fragments of paper, fragments of books that chased high into the night sky. The heat of the blast made us all step back from one another, and embers rained out of the sky, winking out as they fell around us like ashen rain. The crowd moved like a slow-motion wave, edging its way out of the direction of the prevailing wind and the rain of fire. I smelled singed hair and fun fur, and a tall man in a loincloth behind me smacked me between the shoulders, shouting, "You were on fire! Sorry!" I gave him a friendly wave. It was getting too loud to shout any kind of words, and continued to work my way to the edge. Now there were fireworks, and not like the fireworks I'd seen on countless 4th of July nights, fireworks that were artfully arranged to go off in orderly ranks, first one batch and then the next. These were fireworks with tempo. Mortars screaming into the sky without pause, detonations so close together they were nearly one single explosion, a flaring, eye-watering series of booms that didn't let up, driven by the thundering, clashing music from the gigantic art cars behind the crowd, dubstep and funk and punk and some kind of up-tempo swing and even a gospel song, all barely distinguishable. The crowd howled, I howled, the flames licked high, and paper floated high on the thermals, burning bright in the desert night. The smoke was choking, and there were bodies all around me, pressing in, dancing. I felt like I was part of some kind of mass organism with thousands of legs and eyes and throats and voices, and the flames went higher. Soon the library was just a skeleton of structural supports in stark black, surrounded by fiery orange and red. The building teetered, its roof shuddered, the columns rocked and shifted. Each time it seemed the building was about to collapse, the crowd gasped and held its breath, and each time it recovered its balance, we made a disappointed, "Aww." And then, one of the columns gave way, snapping in two, taking the far corner of the roof with it. And the roof sheared downward and pulled free of the other columns, and they fell too. And then the whole thing collapsed in a crash and crackle, sending a fresh cloud of burning paper up in its wake. The Black Rock Rangers pulled back, and we rushed forward, surrounding the wreckage, crowding right up to the burning, crackling pile of lumber and paper and ash. The music got a lot louder. The art cars were pulling in tight now, and there was the occasional boom as a stray firework left in the pile sent up a glowing mortar. It was glorious. It was insane. It was over, and it was time to get moving. "Let's go," I said to Ange. She'd taken the news about Masha calmly, but she'd said, "There's no way I'm letting you go out there alone," when I told her that Masha had insisted on meeting me. "That's what I told her," I said, and Ange stood on tiptoes, reached up, and patted me on the head. "That's my boy," she said. We threaded our way through the dancing, laughing crowd, getting facefuls of wood smoke, pot smoke, sweat, patchouli. Ange loved the smell. I hated it. Ash and playa dust. Soon we found ourselves through the crowd of people and in a crowd of art cars. It was an actual, no-fooling, art car traffic jam. Hundreds of mutant vehicles in a state of pure higgledy-piggledy, so that a three-story ghostly pirate ship on wheels found itself having to navigate through the gap between a tank with the body of a 59 El Camino on a crane arm that held it and its passengers 10 feet off the ground, and a rocking, rolling electric elephant with 10 big-eyed weirdos riding on its howdah. Complicating things was the exodus of playa bikes, ridden with joyous recklessness by laughing, calling, goggled cyclists, and streaming off into the night, becoming distant, erratic comets of bright LEDs, glow sticks, and electroluminescent wire. EL wire was Burning Man's must-have fashion accessory. It was cheap and came in many colors and glowed brightly for as long as the batteries in its pack held out. You could braid it into your hair, pin or glue it to your clothes, or just dangle it from anything handy. Ange's Jawa bandoliers were woven through and through with different colors of pulsing EL wire, and she'd carefully worked a strand into the edge of her hood and another down the hem of her robe, so she glowed like a line drawing of herself from a distance. All my EL wire had been gotten for free by harvesting other people's dead EL wire and painstakingly fixing it, tracking down the shorts and faults and taping them up. I'd done my army surplus boots with EL laces and wound it into coils around my utility belt. Both of us were visible from a good distance, but that didn't stop a few cyclists from nearly running us down. They were very polite and apologetic about it, of course, but they were distracted. Distracted is a permanent state of being on the playa. But as we ventured deeper into the desert, the population thinned out. Black Rock City's perimeter is defined by the trash fence that rings the desert not too far in from the mountain ranges that surround it. These fences catch any moop, matter out of place, that blows out of people's camps where it can be harvested and packed out, leave no trace and all that. Between the trash fence and the center of the city is 2 miles of open playa, nearly featureless, dotted here and there with people, art, and assorted surprises. If 6 o'clock plaza is the sun, and the man and the temple and the camps are the inner solar system, the trash fence is something like the asteroid belt or Pluto. Allow me to pause for a moment here and say, Pluto is too a planet. Now we were walking in what felt like the middle of nowhere. So long as we didn't look over our shoulders at the carnival happening behind us, we could pretend that we were the only people on Earth. Well, almost. We pretty much tripped over a couple who were naked and squirming on a blanket way out in the big empty. It was a dangerous way to get your jollies, but Nookie was a moderately good excuse for being a darktard. And they were pretty good-natured about it, all things considered. Sorry, I called over my shoulder as we moved past them. Time to go dark ourselves, I said. Guess so, Ange said, and fiddled with the battery switch on her bandolier. A moment later, she winked out of existence. I did the same. The sudden dark was so profound that the night looked the same with my eyes open and shut. Look up, Ange said. I did. My God, it's full of stars, I said, which is the joke I always tell when there's a lot of stars in the sky. It's a killer line from the book 2001, though the idiots left it out of the movie. But I'd never seen a sky full of stars like this. The Milky Way, usually a slightly whitish streak even on clear moonless nights, was a glowing, silvery river that sliced across the sky. I'd looked at Mars through binocs once or twice and seen that it was, indeed, a little more red than the other stuff in the sky. But that night, in the middle of the desert, with the playa dust settled for a moment, it glowed like a coal in the lone eye of a cyclopean demon. I stood there with my head flung back, staring wordlessly at the night, until I heard a funny sound, like the patter of water on stone, or... Ange, are you peeing? She shushed me. Just having a sneaky pliopee. The portisans are all the way back there. It'll evaporate by morning. Chill.
One of the occupational hazards of drinking water all the time was that you had to pee all the time, too. Some lucky burners had RVs at their camps with nice private toilets, but the rest of us went to pee camp when we needed to go. Luckily, the bathroom poetry, taped up inside the stalls, made for pretty good reading. Technically, you weren't supposed to pee on the playa, but way out here, the chances of getting caught were basically zero, and it really was a long way back to the toilets. Listening to Ange go made me want to go too, so we enjoyed a playa pee together in the inky warm dark. Walking in the dark, it was impossible to tell how close we were to the trash fence. There was just black ahead of us, with the slightly blacker black of the mountains rising to the lighter black of the starry sky. But gradually, we were able to pick out some tiny flickering lights, candle lights, I thought, up ahead of us, in a long, quavering row. As we got closer, I saw that they were candles. Candle lanterns, actually. Made of tin and glass, each with a drippy candle in it. They were placed at regular intervals, along a gigantic formal dinner table, long enough to seat 50 people at least, with precise place settings and wine glasses and linen napkins folded into tents at each setting. WTF, I said softly. Ange giggled. Someone's art project, she said. A dinner table at the trash fence. Whoa. Hi there, a voice said from the dark, and a shadow detached itself from the table, and then lit up with EL wire, revealing itself to be a young woman with bright purple hair and a leather jacket cut down into a vest. Welcome. Suddenly, there were more shadows turning into people. Three more young women, one with green hair, one with blue hair, and... Hello, Masha, I said. She gave me a little salute. Meet my campmates, she said. You've met before, actually, the day the bridge went. Right, of course. These were the girls who'd been playing on Masha's Harajuku Fun Madness team when we'd run into them in the Tenderloin, moments before the Bay Bridge had been blown up by parties unknown. What did I call them? The Popsicle Squad. Yeah. Nice to see you again, I said. This is Ange. Masha inclined her chin in a minute acknowledgement. They've been good enough to let us use their dinner table for a little conversation, but I don't want to spend too much time out here. Plenty of people looking for me.
Is Zeb here?
He went for a pee, she said. He'll be back soon, but let's get started, okay?
Let's do it, Ange said. She'd stiffened up beside me the minute I'd said hi to Masha, and I had an idea that maybe she wasn't as cool about this meeting as she'd been playing it. Why should she be?
Masha brought us down to the farthest end of the table, away from her friends. We seated ourselves, and I saw that what I'd thought were bread baskets were in fact laden with long-lasting hippie junk food. Whole wheat Pop-Tarts from Trader Joe's, organic beef jerky, baggies of what turned out to be homemade granola, high-energy food that wouldn't melt in the sun. Masha noticed me inspecting the goods and said, "Go ahead, that's what it's there for. Help yourself." I tore into a pack of jerky, stashing the wrapper in my utility belt to throw away later at camp. Turning gift economy snacks into moop was really bad manners, and Ange got herself a Pop-Tart. Just as Masha leaned across the table, opened the little glass door in the candle lantern, and blew the candle out. Now, we were just black blobs in the black night, far from the nearest human, invisible. I felt a hand, Masha's hand, grab my arm in the dark, and feel its way down to my hand, and then push something small and hard into my fingers, then let go. That's a USB stick, a little one. It's a crypto key that will unlock a 4 gigabyte torrent file that you can get with a torrent magnet file on the Pirate Bay and about 10 other torrent sites. It's called insurancefile.masha.torrent, and the checksum's on the USB stick too. I'd appreciate it if you would download and seed the file and ask anyone you trust to do the same.
So, I said, speaking into the dark toward where Masha was sitting. There's this big torrent blob filled with encrypted something floating around on the net, and if something happens, you want me to release the key so that it can be decrypted, right?
Yes, that's about the size of things, Masha said.
I tried to imagine what might be in the insurance file. Blackmail photos, corporate secrets, pictures of aliens at Area 51, proof of Bigfoot's existence.
What's on it? Ange said.
Her voice was a little tight and tense, and though she was trying to hide it, I could tell she was stressing.
Are you sure you want to know that? Masha said. Her voice was absolutely emotionless.
If you want us to do something other than throw this memory stick into a fire, you're goddamn right we do. I can't think of any reason to trust you. Not one.
Masha didn't say anything. She heaved a sigh, and I heard her unscrew a bottle and take a drink of something. I smelled whiskey.
Look, she said. Back when I was, you know, inside at the DHS, I got to know a lot of things. Got to see a lot of things. Got to know a lot of people. Some of those people, they've stayed in touch with me. Not everyone at DHS wants to see America turned into a police state. Some people, they're just doing their jobs, maybe trying to catch actual bad guys, or fight actual crime, or prevent actual disasters. But they get to see things as they do these jobs, things that they're not happy about. Eventually, you come across something so terrible, you can't look yourself in the mirror anymore unless you do something about it. So, maybe you copy some files, pile up some evidence. You think to yourself, someday, someone will have the chance to speak out against this, and I'll quietly slip them these files, and my conscience will forgive me for being part of an organization that's doing such rotten stuff. So what happened is, someone you used to work with, someone who got a bad deal and has been underground and on the road, someone you trust, that person contacts you from deep underground and lets it be known that she'll hold on to all those docs for you, put them together with other people's docs, see if there are any interesting connections between them. That person will take them off your hands, launder them so no one will ever know where they came from, release them when the moment comes. This is quite a nice service to provide for tortured bureaucrats, you see, since it's the kind of thing that lets them sleep at night and still deposit their paychecks. Word gets around. Lots of people find it useful to outsource their conscience to a disgraced runaway outlaw, and, well, stuff does start to trickle in. Then pour in. Soon, you're sitting on gigabytes of that stuff. 4 gigabytes, by any chance? I said. I was feeling a little lightheaded. Masha was giving me the keys to decode all of the ugliest secrets of the American government. All the stuff that had so horrified loyal DHS employees that they'd felt the need to smuggle it out. Masha herself would be so hot that she was practically radioactive. I could hardly believe that space lasers weren't beaming out of the sky to kill her where she sat. And me? Well, once I had the key, no one could be sure I hadn't downloaded the insurance file and had a look. So that meant I was, fundamentally, a dead man.
About that, she said.
Gee, thanks.
You have no right to do this, Ange said. Whatever you're up to, you're putting us in danger without asking us, without us knowing anything about it. How dare you?
Masha cut her off with a sharp shh sound.
Don't shush me, Ange began.
And then I heard, felt, saw Masha grab her and squeeze.
Shut up, she hissed.
Ange shut up. I held my breath. There was the distance, whoop, 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 of terrible dubstep playing from some faraway art car, the soughing of the wind blowing in the slats of the trash fence. And there, had I heard a footstep? Another footstep? Hesitant stumbling in the dark? A soft crunch. There it was again. Crunch. Crunch. Closer now. And I felt Masha coil up, get ready to run, and I tasted the beef jerky again as it rose in my throat, buoyed up on a fountain of stomach acid. My ears hammered with my pulse, and the sweat on the back of my neck dried to ice in an instant. Crunch. Crunch. The steps were practically upon us now, and there was a bang that made me jump as Masha leaped away from the table, knocked over her chair, and set off into the dark of the playa. Then there was a blazing light right in my face, blinding me, and a hand reaching out for me, and I scrambled away from it, grabbing for Ange, screaming something in wordless terror, Ange shouting too, and then a voice said, "Hey, Marcus, stop, it's me!" I knew that voice, though I'd only heard it for an instant long ago on the street in front of Chavez High. "Zeb?" I said. "Dude!" he shouted, and I was grabbed up in a tight, somewhat smelly hug, my face pressed against his whiskered cheek. His blazing headlamp blinded me, but from what I could feel, he'd grown a beard of the same size and composition as a large animal, a big cat, or possibly a beaver. The terror drained out of me, but left behind all its nervous energy, and I found myself laughing uproariously. Suddenly, small, strong hands separated us, and Zeb was rolling on the playa, tackled by Masha, who must have circled back and recognized his voice. She was calling him all sorts of names as she wrestled him to the ground, straddling his chest and pinning his arms under her elbows. "Sorry! Sorry!" he said. And he was laughing, too. And so was Masha, and so was Ange, for that matter. "Sorry, okay? I just didn't want to disturb you. The girls told me you were down here. I thought a light would kill the atmosphere." Masha let him up and gave him a kiss in a spot on his cheek where his beard was a little thinner. "You are such an idiot," she said. He laughed again and tousled her hair. Masha was a totally different person with Zeb, playful and younger and not so totally lethal. I liked her better. "Ange, this is Zeb. Zeb, this is Ange." He shook her hand. "I've heard of you," she said. "And I've heard of you, too," he said. "Okay, sit down, you idiots, and turn off that damned light, Zeb." Masha was getting her down to business voice back, and we did what she said. I still felt angry at her for what she'd done to us, but after being scared witless and then let down an instant later, it was hard to get back to that angry feeling. All my adrenaline had been dumped into my bloodstream already, and it would take a while to manufacture some more, I guess. Still, things were far from settled. "Masha," I said, "you know that what you've done here is really unfair, right?" I couldn't see or hear her in the dark, and the silence stretched on so long I thought maybe she'd fallen asleep or tiptoed away. Then, suddenly, she said, "God, you're still a kid, aren't you?" The way she said it made me feel like I was about 8 years old, like I was some kind of hayseed with cow crap between my toes, and like she was some kind of world-traveling super spy, underground fugitive ninja. "Up yours," I said, trying to make it sound cynical and mean, not like I was a widow kid with hurt feelings. I don't think I was very successful. She gave a mean laugh. "I mean it. Fair? What's fair got to do with anything? There is stuff going on in the world, bad stuff, the kind of stuff that ends up with dead people in shallow graves, and you're either part of the solution or you're part of the problem. Is it fair to all the people who risked everything to get me these docs for you to walk away from them because you don't want to have your safe little life disrupted? Oh, Mikey, you're such a big hero. After all, you bravely told other people's stories to a reporter? Because you held a press conference? What a big, brave man," she spat loudly. "Yeah, it got me. Because you know what? She was right. Basically, give or take. There'd been plenty of nights when I lay in bed and stared at the ceiling and thought exactly these thoughts. There'd been kids in the X-Net who did stuff that was way crazier than anything I'd done. Kids whose jamming had put them right up against Homeland Security and the cops. Kids who'd ended up in jail for a long time without any newspaper coverage advertising their bravery. Some of them were probably still in there. The fact that I didn't know for sure. Didn't even know all their names or how many there were. Was yet another reason that I didn't deserve anyone's admiration. Every bit of clever, flashy wit ran and hid in the furthest corners of my mind. I heard Zeb shuffle his feet uncomfortably. No one knew what to say. Except Ange.
Well, I suppose not everyone can be a sellout, she said. Not everyone can be a snitch who gets to sit in the hidden bunkers and spy on the ones who are getting beaten and jailed and tortured and disappeared. Not everyone can draw a fat salary for their trouble until the day comes that it's all too much for their poor little conscience and they just have to go and run away to a beach in Mexico somewhere, lying in the bed they made for themselves.
It made me smile, there in the dark. Go, Ange. Whatever my sins were, they were sins of omission. I could have done more. But Masha'd done the worst kind of evil. Sins of commission. She'd done wrong. Really, really wrong. She'd tried to make up for it since. But she was in no position to shame me. Another one of those long silences. I thought about dropping the USB stick in the dust and walking off in the dark. You know what stopped me? Zeb. Because Zeb was a hero. He'd broken out of Gitmo by the Bay, and instead of running, he'd come and found me at Chavez High so that he could pass on Daryl's note. He could have just hit the road, but he hadn't. And I'd told his secrets to the world, put him in harm's way. This wasn't just Masha's mission. This was Zeb's mission, too. They were a team. I owed him. We all did. Enough, I said, swallowing hard on all the stupid emotions, trying to find some of that Zen calm I'd attained at the temple. Enough. Fine. It's not fair. Life's not fair. I've got this thing now. What do I do with it? Keep it safe, Masha said, her voice back in that emotionless zone that I guessed she was good at finding when she needed it. And if you ever hear that I've gone down, or Zeb's gone down, release it. Shout it from the mountaintops. If I ever ask you to release it, release it. And if you haven't heard from me by the Friday of the next Burning Man, 1 year from now, release it. Do you think you can do that?
Sounds like something I could manage, I said.
I figure even you can't screw this up, she said. But I could tell she was just putting up her tough chick front, and I didn't take it personally. Okay, fine. I'm out of here. Don't screw up, all right? I heard her feet crunch away.
See you at camp, babe.
Zeb called at her retreating back, and his headlamp came back on, dazzling me again. He grabbed a Pop-Tart from the basket and opened it, chewed at it enthusiastically. I love that girl. Honestly, I do, but she is so tightly wound. It was so manifestly true that there was nothing for it but to laugh. And so we did. And it turned out that Zeb had some beer that he gift economied to us, and I had some cold brew coffee concentrate in a flask that we dipped into afterwards, just to get us back up from the beer's mellow down. And then we all needed pee camp, and we went back into the night and the playa, and the dust.